I'm Mark Chapman. Welcome to the Planet Premier League podcast. Each week, Cesc Fabregas, Nader Manua and myself talk all things Premier League.
As a player, you don't have time to talk.
No.
You don't have time to make a plan. You just need to deal with wave after wave after wave.
We watched Coach Carter and he said, oh, afterwards, the game's just about doing this for your teammates. And I remember looking around halfway through the film and half the squad was asleep.
Planet Premier League. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Hey, everybody, this is Richard Deitch, and welcome to the Sports Media Podcast. My producer is Patrick Antonetti. My guest today is someone I've written about a little bit. I really have immense respect for him, a young broadcaster chronologically, but has really done some exceptional work. Adam Amin is a play-by-play commentator for ESPN. He joined the company in 2011 at age 24, so you can do the math, young guy. One of the youngest network, or one of the network's youngest game callers. Adam, let me know how great I am at reading your ESPN PR bio here.
I'm cringing. I realize how hard I'm cringing and how much my eyes are rolling into the back of my head the more I hear this. I hope you realize that.
Yeah, first of all, my God, like, imagine the person who has to put all these bios together. I mean, that's what did you do in a past life?
It might be a ninth circle of hell type of job, in all honesty, if whoever has to put these together. I feel bad for the Anna DeGrons and the Derek Volners of the world right now.
My hope is that it's Josh Krulowitz if it's this bad. Anyway, so Adam Amin is a so he calls a ton of stuff. Thursday Night College Football on ESPN, Women's Final Four, college basketball, now the NBA, does MLB. He's called the NFL on ESPN Radio for a number of years. His resume at ESPN also includes like the College World Series, Nathan's Hot Dog Eating Contest. I know he's done wrestling, volleyball. So primarily his work now, I think you see him when it comes to college football. Certainly listen to him on the NFL on ESPN, but he has done a ton of work for ESPN in a number of different sports, and we'll get into that a little bit in our conversation. I should note, too, Adam, correct me if my dates are off here, but over the last 2 years, you have done the Chicago Bears preseason NFL mm-hmm. as well, correct? That's television, not radio?
Yeah, the preseason TV broadcast. So, you know, the local the teams always hire locally, and we get to do the games on the local affiliates. So it's been great. Another good experience to have, and a relatively, like, I hate calling it an easy gig because nothing is easy, but it's like, it's just fun. You know, it's like a hometown gig. Who wouldn't want to do that?
Now, what a year for your accountant, Adam. Congratulations to him or her for all these different jobs. All right, Adam Amin joins me on the Sports Media Podcast. All right, Adam, here is, by the way, that was one of the worst intros I've ever had, but still probably a better intro than I've had with your buddy.
It's very exciting, though, Richard, because all it took for me to jump on your podcast was Adnan Burke badgering you at least 17 times on Twitter, and then for me and Ravel to have like a 35-minute Twitter spat, and now all of a sudden, here we are together. This is what I've been waiting for.
Actually, what I'm going to do is, actually, in post-production, Adnan Burke is going to just, he's going to read the intro. He's going to, it's going to be him introing you as opposed to me. We're going to bring him in as,
perfect.
Yeah, as my sort of body double here. All right, so here, I mean, listen, Adam, there's a lot of things I can talk to you about, but this is where I want to start. Because, you know, rare is it that a sort of something happens on social media, particularly Twitter, which is like a burst of positivity and gets and goes viral. But in this case, on Thursday, December 19th, which, and tell me again if I have any of these facts wrong, which was your 33rd birthday, the next morning, you're on a flight heading back home, I assume to Chicago, after taking a week off for a vacation, and you get this idea as you're on a plane, and I will let you take over from there. What happened?
I was just, we had some time to burn, and I've done this in the past. I'm on a flight, I'm bored, or trying to procrastinate if I'm prepping for a game or something, and I'll jump on Twitter and say, you know, for the next 15, 20 minutes, I'll answer any questions about college football or food takes or whatever. And I should credit my friend Dan Rubenstein, who does a great job on the Solid Verbal. He's a college football podcaster. I've ripped this idea off from him at various points. So, but just like, hey, here's 15 minutes. I need something to get my brain occupied from something other than what we're reading about. So I figured, you know, let's do that once in a while. And this time, for whatever reason, I don't know what it was, you know, and I said maybe it was the combination of being relaxed and being reflective, being another year older, I guess, by time's definition. I figured, all right, let me kind of take some stock in what's going on. And it was nice to be away from from doing the job for a week. I didn't have my laptop with me. I felt a little bit more clear-headed. And this kind of just struck me as, hey, let me, you know, give me 16 minutes and I'll say something nice about somebody that you like in the media. You know, just mention somebody, and if I have a story about them, I'll share it. If I don't know them, but I've seen their work, you know, I'll say something nice about them. And for 15, 16 minutes, that's what I did. And then I enjoyed it. I realized it felt good, you know, saying these things and sharing these anecdotes and saying positive things about people that I happen to enjoy or you happen to enjoy. It felt good. And these responses, for whatever reason, they resonated with people and they kept pouring in, and people wanted to know about these autonomous, you know, names and faces that not everybody gets a chance to know personally. And I'm lucky enough in a lot of senses to know a lot of these people personally and to appreciate the work just like all these fans do. And I just couldn't stop responding. I probably felt guilty at one point. I'm like, well, I don't want somebody to say something or mention somebody here and me say something nice about them, and somebody else gets mentioned and I don't say anything. It makes it look like I don't like these people. And I'm sure I missed a bunch of people, but it turned into the rest of the flight, which turned into the cab ride back to my apartment, which turned into sitting on the couch for most of the afternoon and just kind of reflecting on all these nice and interesting and intelligent and talented people that I've been able to cross paths with. And I do feel that way about a lot of these people. I just don't always say it out loud. And I think most of us probably do. I'm sure a lot of us feel bitter and angry towards some of these people at various points too, which is part of the competition of the business. But at the end of the day, if I take stock and kind of sit back and reflect on all these people, I have a lot of respect for the people that do this job. And I just kept responding, and it just felt better and better, and it felt positive and it felt good and all the nice things. So I think that's kind of what triggered it.
How many reflections of colleagues did you ultimately get to? Did you ultimately offer some thoughts on more than 100 colleagues, or what? Do you have any sense of what the final number was at the end?
I don't know what the final number was. I think it was in the triple digits. I think so, just based on how many tweets I ended up seeing. You know, there were so many responses. I think there were, I haven't looked at it in a little bit, but I'm sure it was something like 400 tweets in response to the original thread. So I'd like to think, you know, maybe 100 of those I responded to, but it was a lot of people. I did feel like I ran the gamut, and there were people I didn't even know. There were a bunch of people that, well, I want to know about this person. I don't necessarily know that person. Jamie Erdahl. I don't know Jamie Erdahl, but somebody asked and I've watched a lot of her work. So, and she just happened to pop into my head. So, you know, there are plenty of people that I don't even have a personal relationship with, and I still felt strongly about their work, and I have a lot of respect for what they do.
I want to ask you why you think this went viral, but let's sort of be honest with the audience. I mean, you know, part of the reason, of course, is you're an ESPN broadcaster. It's the biggest name, biggest sports brand in the United States. And when someone at ESPN does something, many times it's news, but you know, other ESPN people, other Fox people, the CBS people probably done similar stuff. Do you have any sense as to why this popped? Because I happen to see it. I think some people on Twitter sort of gave me the heads up, but I saw it like on a Twitter moment, like somebody who's a curator at Twitter decided to basically tag it as, you know, the sportscaster who provides joy, whatever it was. It was a good title. But you know what I'm saying? They clearly, their algorithm picked up that like this was gaining some traction, and let's sort of expose it to a bigger audience. And then obviously once it goes to Twitter moments, it's the kind of thing that is going to expand beyond just your universe. I don't know. The holidays, why do you think it hit? What do you think it was?
I saw the moment. That was pretty cool. And it said like, perhaps in the spirit of the holidays or something like that, which, Maybe people were looking for it, you know. Maybe people were looking for a little bit of positivity, because I'm sure I've been looking for it. And like you said, I have a lot of good friends and great colleagues at ESPN who have large platforms and followings, and I happen to say nice things about them, so I'm sure they shared it, and it was nice to see kind of the reciprocation of it at times as well. But I'm sure everything you said, it's a confluence of all those things. It's people with large platforms, and I think people kind of crave it. I think people were maybe craving it, a little bit of positivity in a cesspool that is Twitter. You know, this hellscape of an app that seemingly brings us down with terrible news and racist comments on a consistent basis. Maybe people were just craving it a little bit, and I know I was too. You know, like, you know, Richard, we've had conversations in the past, and you know, and let me also say I appreciate what you've written about, you know, my family and the piece you wrote before the 2018 Final Four. Yeah, I certainly appreciate that, and I've expressed that to you, and let me express that publicly. So I appreciated that. But in that last year and a half, you know, I haven't felt the same, in all honesty, you know, and you get hardened by a couple of things and life events and tumult and things of that nature. And I finally got to a point where I've been feeling a little bit better. And I think I wanted it. I wanted to kind of breed some positivity. And I think other people probably feel the same way, you know, whether it's the time of year or not. Maybe whether it's the climate of the country or not, I don't know, but I could certainly see people wanting to grasp onto something. And the fact that this happened to have a lot of people with decently large platforms, on this particular app, maybe it's just the confluence of all those things, but I know I was craving it. Like I said, the more I did it, the more I responded, it just felt good. It felt better. I felt better. So I think that had a lot to do with it.
Yeah, that's well said. I mean, Twitter can be a hellscape, let's just be honest, many days or most days. And I do think there is a craving many times for something positive, particularly in a time of like massive polarization. And I wish I could be a little less cynical about this, Adam, but I think 2020 is going to be worse on that than 2019. That said, there are times on social media where I do think like these kind of acts, like they may not have a long lasting impact for people, but at the moment, I do think they provide something important. You know, they just provide like a reminder that like we're all sometimes in this together, and sometimes we forget that.
Yeah, I agree, and I'm with you, man. I do think that. You know, that cynicism strikes me. And I wrote this in, you know, a little follow-up thing with our PR staff. I at times while I was doing this, I kind of felt fraudulent. You know, I'm like, I don't always feel this way. I hope people realize that. And I don't want to, I also think it's okay to not feel 100% positive 100% of the time. And I know I don't, I'm sure people don't, nobody does for the most part. And as much as you try, it's not always going to feel that way. And I know that oftentimes we only put out into social media and into this landscape what we believe is going to be perceived as positive stuff. I've had plenty of moments on Twitter where I'm just like, I hate everything that's happening, and I'm frustrated and I'm angry. And I have these conversations more in private than I do in public, but I don't feel this way 100% of the time. And I think the more I try to push myself to feel that way. There's this old psychology that if you just force yourself to smile, suddenly your demeanor will shift, or at least gradually it will shift, just because your body feels the necessity to match, or your mind feels the necessity to match what your body's doing. And, you know, sometimes you just need to force yourself to be positive at times, or be happy, or be joyous, or be friendly, or whatever it may be. And sometimes your mind and your body just click and respond in that fashion. And I don't always feel that way, but it's nice for my own self, for my own, you know, just mental capacity to feel better. And it, like I said, the more I did this, the better I felt. And it left me in a good mood for a good chunk of time. And it's not going to last. It's not always going to feel that way. I'm going to get frustrated again, or I'm going to be tired or angry or whatever again at some point. And I don't think I should feel bad about that. And nor should anybody feel bad about that. But I also think it's good to remind yourself, hey, the more you try to kind of push yourself in the direction of being positive or being happy or trying to spread something joyous as much as possible, as much as you possibly can, it really does affect your overall demeanor and overall mood, and it did help mine. So I hope that maybe that resonates with some people, but I don't want people to think that I'm like, I've got this aura of just positivity all the time, because I sure as hell don't. I just don't. And nobody does. But the more you can do it, I think it makes everybody else around you feel a little bit better too.
Adam, last week I had a long conversation with Kevin Harlan about his schedule and how he juggles his basketball work with his CBS television work. And then his
was this while he was calling a game and doing the interview with you as
probably
well?
He was
that was
yeah,
that'd, prob- be, prob- that'd be just probably, as impressive as what he did the other day. That was awesome.
Yeah, well, he probably was calling a game while talking to me. But you are someone who has called a multitude of sports at a pretty still early stage of your broadcasting career, and I wonder for you if let me just sort of ask an overall question. But how have you tried to get comfortable with calling so many different sports that have different cadences, different rhythms, different rules, different partners, different everythings?
I think it's because I didn't know any better when I first got hired, and why would I? You know, I think we're used to seeing younger people do this job more and more and more over just the last decade alone. But I think when I got hired, there weren't a lot of us that were around my age that were doing this. You know, I think it was me, maybe Joe Davis. You know, Jason Benetti hadn't kind of come on the scene at that point. Mike Cousins hadn't really jumped on the scene at that point. Ryan Rucco was a little bit more local and was a little bit more geared on radio at that point. So there weren't a lot of us doing it on a national stage just yet. So for any of us doing it at that age, all we're trying to do is keep a job. You know, like when I got hired, I had a 1-year deal, and I was just petrified that I was going to get let go. So when they call me and ask, hey, do you want to do the NCAA Wrestling Championships? And I'm like, yeah, of course. Why wouldn't I want to do that? Hey, do you want to do, college softball and college baseball? Of course. Why wouldn't I want to do that? And I think you just get caught in this spot where you better do it. You better do these games. You better do all these sports. Otherwise, you know, we'll go find somebody else. And while that may or may not have been the case, it certainly felt that way. So it's kind of all I've known since I started doing this. And I think it just forces you into that corner where you're like, if I don't learn, if it's fight or flight, I guess, in a lot of ways, if I don't learn this stuff and I don't do a good job with it, I don't know if I'm going to have any employment, you know, a year from now or 2 years from now. So it kind of started from there. And then when all these other opportunities kept getting added, hey, you're going to get hired to do the NFL. You know, it was 2012 and Sports USA Radio hired me to do NFL games. Yeah, sure, of course. And then they said, hey, do you want to do Major League Baseball on the radio? Yeah, of course I want to do that. Eventually, can you do the NBA? Of course I can do the NBA. Do you want to do, you know, this? Do you want to do women's basketball, men's basketball? Do you want to jump into this sport and that sport? And I just didn't know any better. And I'm glad it kind of worked out this way. But I also think I'm a guy who needs reps. I'm a reps guy. I think there are some people who are just magically or naturally talented at this job. In particular, doing play-by-play, I am not one of those people. I do not believe I'm one of those people. I think I had to do this over and over and over and over again and become a robot and a machine in some capacity to have this ingrained, so that when I do show up and do a game on radio, you know, like we did the other day, and I hadn't called a game on radio in a couple of weeks, I can jump back in and feel like I'm ready to go and I can get back into a rhythm relatively quickly. But I am not one of those people who is just naturally talented at this. I look around and I see so many people, friends of mine, colleagues of mine. I just think you just have a natural feel for this. And I am one of those people who just doesn't. So a combination of those things, out of necessity, out of fear, I think that's how it kind of ended up this way, where I call all these different sports and multiple mediums. And I think part of it is just I wanted to keep the job.
Adam, do you feel most comfortable in one sport? And if so, what is that sport?
I don't think I do. I honestly don't. And I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. I don't know what my best sport is. I don't know what my best medium is. I really don't know. I think it shifts day to day. And like I said, it's because I don't think there's a natural talent for this, for me. Not for other people, but for me, I just don't think I'm naturally good at this. So it just becomes getting into the mode of that game that day. And I know this might sound like a super weird answer, or it sounds like inside baseball to anybody who, you know, may not have an understanding, a clear understanding of what it is that we do. But honestly, I think it's a day-to-day, game-to-game thing where you feel comfortable, do you feel prepared? Do you feel confident? Do you feel comfortable with the rhythms and machinations of the sport and the medium that you're covering? I think if those things are kind of lined up, then yeah, it's going to be a good game and you're going to feel comfortable. You're going to feel like this is your sport. And that's kind of how I want to feel day to day. I want to feel like I own that game, but I think it fluctuates day to day and game to game.
Roughly, how many events do you think you will work in 2020?
I would probably guess like a typical contract, year. I think it's like I'll give you a little inside baseball. I'm contracted to do 95 events for ESPN. And then on top of that, you add a few games for, like you said, the Bears, and I do some Bulls fill-in, in locally in Chicago. And so usually it's around 100 to 110 events a year overall.
And so can you give me – I know you have – Michigan, Alabama on January 1st. I'll ask you about that because that's kind of a very cool college football assignment. But give, like, the listeners just, like, a little bit of a sense of what your January would be like.
We'll start with that, obviously. And that will be, that Michigan-Alabama game is my fourth game, I think, in 8 days, because I started last week with Christmas in Toronto, like you mentioned, Richard. We did the Pinstripe Bowl this past Friday. I had an NFL game this past Sunday, and then the Citrus Bowl on New Year's Day. I'll fly back home to Chicago after the game on Wednesday on New Year's Day. I come back to Houston, where I'm at right now, on January 3rd to do a college basketball game. I've got a UConn game the following Thursday. We go to New Orleans for the college football championship. I'll head back home after that on the 14th. I go to Oregon for a Thursday the 16th game. We've got a great women's game, top five matchup, top 10 matchup, depending on the polls, Oregon and Stanford. I'll red eye from Oregon back to Chicago and then take the first flight from Chicago to Philadelphia on that Friday. I've got a Bulls game in Philadelphia against the 76ers. So, between doing all these, there's the last week of January, I've got a Wednesday Bulls game in Indianapolis, a Thursday women's game in Notre Dame, a Friday Bulls game in Brooklyn, and a Saturday NBA game in Boston, and then a Monday women's game at UConn. So that's a 5-game and 6-day stretch when we're in the thick of basketball season. So that's kind of how sometimes these months, they play out. And a lot of it is scheduling because, hey, if I can't do a Bulls game for the team, if they ask, hey, would you mind filling in? If I can't do it, it's logistically impossible. I'm not going to say yes to it because I don't want to put other people into a bad situation. But if I feel like I can get there, I can make it, I can logistically get there, and I'm not going to be dead by the time I get there, then I will make sure that I'm ready to go and prepared and ready to do a game for you. And I think that comes from the other people who do it like this, the Ian Eagles of the world, the Kevin Harlans of the world, two people I have great and immense respect for, the Mike Tiricos of the world who were, one of those jack of all trades type of people at ESPN. And obviously he did it at such a high level, but he did so much. This is kind of how we're bred to do this. I don't know if we're just idiots. We don't know any better. We're greedy. I have no idea, but this is kind of how these months end up playing out for me.
That's an amazing schedule. I appreciate you sharing that with the audience. It gives people a sense of just how busy you are. All right, let's take a break from our conversation for a second to talk about Sleep Number. The new year is now upon us, and which resolutions do you plan to conquer in 2020? I got a number of them, but when it comes to sleep, the one I want is to improve my sleep routine, the amount of sleep I get, the quality of sleep I get. And so that is a big goal for me in 2020. It should be a goal basically for all of us as we get older. The importance of sleep, just you cannot emphasize that enough. So let's say you want to go out and you want to stick to an improved sleep routine. You want to become more mindful, create a healthier lifestyle through diet, exercise, and of course, sleep. Now, how are you going to do that? Well, let's talk about the Sleep Number 360-degree smart bed. That helps everyone get the proven quality sleep that will change your life. And you use the Sleep IQ app to help create your routine. Now, what are the benefits of the Sleep Number 360 smart bed? Here's why it's the smartest choice for better sleep and the best bed for couples. Sleep number beds allow you to adjust to each side so you can get your ideal firmness, your comfort, and support. The Sleep Number 360 smart bed senses your movements and automatically adjusts to keep you sleeping comfortably through the night. That is huge. With Sleep IQ technology inside the bed, it tracks how you're sleeping and gives you personalized insights for your best sleep. So basically, this bed is catered to you. Cannot recommend it enough. All right, it's time for you to discover proven quality sleep. And now, during the lowest prices of the season, a Queen Sleep Number 360 Degree C4 Smart Bed is only $1,299. That's a savings of $400. You can get this for only a limited time at a Sleep Number store or go to sleepnumber.com/cadence, C-A-D-E-N-C-E, sleepnumber.com/cadence. Everybody wants to get a great night of sleep, and now you can with Sleep Number.
Check out our new NBA show, Beyond the Arc, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network, where you can find me, John Gonzalez, NBA insider Bill Reiter, and Ashley Nicole Moss 5 days a week talking all things NBA. Whether you're looking for insightful discussions, upbeat commentary, breaking news, interviews, or coverage of all the biggest stories in the NBA, our new show is the place to be 5 days a week. Download and follow Beyond the Arc on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Something I'm curious about, and you could sort of take this in whatever direction you want. Because of your job, Adam, you have a lot of production meetings with coaches. Now, you know, obviously, I don't know how much you might get when you're doing the NFL for ESPN Radio. My sense is you're not getting the same kind of production that Tessitore, McFarland, Nance Romo get. But when you do college football, and you've done major college football, you obviously have sit-downs with coaches and sometimes players. And now you've done a little bit of the NBA, and maybe you've gotten that as well. Can you just give me a sense, at least from your experience, what sport have you found coaches and players to be the most forthcoming? And conversely, what sport have you found where the coaches and the players might be a little bit more reticent to the people who are broadcasting the game in terms of information, et cetera?
Sure. That's a great question, actually, because I think the dynamic of this has a lot to do with the pay grade. I think when you deal with people who are professionals, so NBA, Major League Baseball is part of this as well. You know, Brad Stevens is going to be forthcoming about his rotation or who's hurt or what they want to do against the other team. And they have an understanding of, hey, these guys are going to be here. They see it on TV. We get, you know, these athletes get paid a lot of money. It's part of their job to deal with the media in as forthright of a fashion as they possibly can, or how much they feel comfortable with, obviously. But, you know, I'm around Richard Jefferson doing some NBA games. I've been around PJ Carlissimo and John Barry and Doris Burke, and, you know, players know them, you know, whether they played or not, whether they're, you know, Doris is a veteran broadcaster, PJ's a veteran coach, Richard just got out of the league. So they're going to be forthright with them, whether it's on the air or off the air. Or for on air or for off air or for on the record or off the record or just for background info or just talking during a shoot around or a layup line or whatever it may be. I think when you're a pro, you kind of let go of some of that hesitance and some of that apprehension, because it's like, this is my job and this is what these people get paid for. I'm assuming they're not idiots. I'm going to assume that they have a respect for me as a professional. So I'm okay with telling them certain things and assuming that they're going to have an idea about how to say them. When you're doing some of these meetings with college coaches, and understandably, I certainly would prefer they be forthright with us, but I also understand that they're in a weird situation with a bunch of kids. Like, these are not professional athletes. These are 18 to 23 year old kids that they're in charge of. So how much they give us is going to fluctuate. And I understand that college kids, especially if you're an 18 or 19 year old freshman, who's playing in their first big game as a college football player, and we get a chance to sit down with you, if you haven't done a whole lot of that, then you're going to be relatively hesitant. This was the case, I remember, with Lamar Jackson the year that he won the Heisman Trophy. You know, the Louisville staff was hesitant to put him out on a big stage. I think it was his sophomore year. Like, they don't want to put him in a spot where he's uncomfortable. This is a 19, 20-year-old kid. I want to ask questions about his background, about his family, about his play, about what he wants to do in the future. But if he's not comfortable answering those questions, or he's not used to having to answer those questions just yet, he's not going to be as forthright about it. And that's okay. I can't put my expectations of a professional athlete onto a college kid the same way I do with somebody who gets paid and somebody who doesn't get paid. So I think that's kind of important to have that distinction, but I think that's mainly where the distinction lies.
All right, Adam, understanding that this was reported by John Orand of the Sports Business Daily. CBS has confirmed that they have pulled out of negotiation. ESPN has not confirmed anything. So I'm giving this preamble to sort of protect you. Yeah, I want people to know that this is not Adam Amin reporting this or anything else. This is me about to ask him a hypothetical, but it's a hypothetical that I think everybody knows is going to be the truth. John Orand of Sports Business Daily reported that ESPN is going to ultimately land the premium SEC football package. That's right now the SEC on CBS, 15 to 17 games, including the conference championship, most watched college football series over the past decade and beyond. Obviously, this is Alabama versus Auburn. You know, this is great college football. CBS will have it until I think 2023, and then ESPN takes over. So this is what I want to get to with you, Adam. Let us make the assumption for now that this is correct and that ESPN is going to get this. Can you give me a sense of how in demand you think this package would be for broadcasters at your place? Because it strikes me that, you know, it's not every day where this kind of package comes to your employer. And I would have to think there have to be, and maybe you'd be one of them, but I would have to think there would be so many play-by-play people and analyst people and sideline reporter people at your place who would really, really love the opportunity to work that kind of caliber college football.
Of course. I mean, I'm sure, you know, I'd be one of several who would want to be in consideration for something like that. And like you said, every position would want to be in consideration for everybody in each position would want to be in consideration for something like that. You know, it's so tough because it is a hypothetical right now and there is no confirmation. And I am certainly not smart enough, or nor do I actually give a shit enough to care about how the machinations work. Like, all right, well, we're going to make this the ABC window at 3:30, and we're going to put an SEC game in there. Now Fowler and Herbie are going to call the primetime game because it's LSU-Alabama. And what is how does everything else around it work? I'm not smart enough, and nor do I care enough, like at this point, to really dive all in on how it's going to be structured. But if you say, hey, would you want to do that 3:30 ABC SEC window? Yeah, of course. Who wouldn't want to do that? But the only concern I have, and I'm not saying this is, like, as you properly prefaced, this is John Orand reporting, and as I should preface, this is just my own viewpoint of it, which has nothing to do with, like, how it actually is. Because, like I said, I don't know, nor do I really have an interest in knowing. I don't know if it suddenly becomes more diluted. Is it, well, now we got to move, you know, this conference to this window, so we're only going to make this an ESPN window? Does the SEC completely dominate the ABC windows? Like, are we concerned about any type of conference bias at this point? Which, by the way, love the conspiracy theorists talking about Clemson and Ohio State this weekend, which I'm sure nobody's wanted to egg those people on, but love the conspiracy theories. Keep them coming, guys. I just don't know enough to feel like I have a great grasp of how the machinations work. And if this does move over, here's the other concern I have, just based on the TV landscape. I will say, as a compliment to CBS, they made the SEC on CBS feel special. Like, that 3:30 window felt special. And I'm sure a lot of it had to do with the limitations that, that are put on, you know, our network, because, you know, the SEC has an exclusive window and things like that. Fowler and Herbie don't get to call broadcast games, you know, on ABC. So they have to slide over to ESPN a couple times a year if there's a big primetime SEC game. But I think my concern is, does it change the specialness? Does it change the uniqueness of what that window was? And does it just kind of get swallowed up into the whole ESPN ABC machine? Or is it going to feel like one of those special windows the way it did for so long on CBS? So is it going to have that same value? I'm not sure. And I hope it does. I hope it's just a special on ESPN or ABC or whatever the hell they decide to put it on. But I don't know enough to really feel confident in kind of analyzing that just yet. But I do think those are some things that a lot of people are going to be asking questions about.
No, listen, those are all great questions. And those are all the questions that ultimately are going to have to be answered. So I appreciate you going there. It's going to be one of the more fascinating stories to watch. Can I just say before we get to the last?
Are you 55 million? The number shocked me, by the way, that it was just 55 million. Again, I'm so unaware of these things. 55 million for that package, that is amazing. That is impressive stuff from the CBS economy.
One of the great sports rights deals of the last, easily of the last 25 plus years was CBS's deal. But, you know, again, it goes sort of part and parcel. It's like, well, great product, obviously, but how much also was CBS part of raising the profile to get the dollars to where they're ultimately going to be? But I must say, Adam, you're welcome to sort of expand on this. There's always just loads of nonsense on Twitter. I mean, like I said, it is a daily hellscape that it's amazing more people aren't jumping out of windows after reading that site. But the conspiracy theory against ESPN when it came to the Ohio State Clemson game was, I mean, that's one of the more fun, fantastic, insane circuses I've seen in a long time. Like the idea, one, that ESPN is somehow involved in this is just in itself like, you know, Zapruder film nonsense. But let's sort of expand that a little bit. Like, if ESPN truly wanted to, like, fix a college football championship where they can get the opponents that they would want, like, anyone who like has the ability to use Google can pretty much see that Ohio State and Alabama are far and away the most viewed television teams and have been for the last decade. Like, you would kill to have those teams in any kind of combination in the final. So the people who think that ESPN somehow is dictating Clemson to be in the national championship game because ESPN wants more publicity for the ACC network, man, that's just fantastic city to see.
Oh, the reach. I love the reach, just the extension of the arms to try to reach and grasp this type of concept from some of the fans out there. Listen, part of the reason college football is as popular as it is because, and again, this is just my opinion that has nothing to do with ESPN. I don't love the structure of college football. I don't like the 4-team playoff, and that's okay if you disagree with me. I think certain years it feels better that it's just 4 teams. This year it kind of felt appropriate because there are 3 really, really, really good teams and everybody else is just fairly good relative to those 3 teams. I think it's obvious Clemson, Ohio State, LSU are the 3 best teams in college football, and then there's a gap. So this year maybe 4-team playoff is perfect. But maybe this is the city guy in me, this is the Chicago in me, growing up in a pro sports town and kind of having an idea of structure. Like, when you win your division, you get into the playoffs, and then anything can happen, and you get ranked based on how you won your division. You know, here, the regionality of it is kind of going away. It's a more nationalized sport. I would be a proponent of, hey, if you're going to have power conferences, why don't you just put the champions of those conferences into a playoff, and then you got 3 wild card teams, however you want to do it, throw a group of 5 team in there. That's fine. I would love a situation like that. And fans don't necessarily want to do that, and that's fine. Again, I'm not here to argue the rights or wrongs of it. I just would prefer a structure and system that has a little bit more consistency and a little bit more value to a lot more games. Yeah, you might diminish the value of an LSU-Alabama game a little bit during the regular season, but you might exponentially raise the value of an LSU-Vanderbilt game or an Alabama-Arkansas game because they have to win that game to make sure they're in position to make the SEC title game or whatever it may be. Like, I would just prefer a structure that's a little bit more equitable. And then some of these arguments just go out the window. But I just feel like that's something that hurts the sport a little bit when you don't have this regionality anymore. But part of the reason college football is as popular as it is because these debates rage on for months. I mean, weeks at a time, people are screaming at each other on Twitter, screaming at people who release the playoff rankings on a week-to-week basis come November. And that's what drives a lot of the interest in the sport. No, your team's not as good as my team. My team's better than this team and that team, but we beat that team even though we lost. We only lost by 2 points to that team on the road without our starting quarterback for half. Like, this is how these debates get structured, and that lights a lot of the fire for this sport, and that keeps the interest going, where the NFL, there's interest in it every single week because there is an already inherent value to each game. Hey, if I win this game, it's going towards my record in my own division. Oh, we have two games against our divisional opponent. We have to win those so we can make the playoffs. Like, following Dallas and Philly yesterday, while we're calling a Tennessee Titans game, while following the Pittsburgh-Baltimore game and the Oakland-Denver game and trying to kind of navigate through that, it makes week 17 of the NFL really fun. That debate is a little different in college football, but it drives it throughout the season. So I think that's part of the reason it is as popular as it is, and you have to get through the yelling and the screaming sometimes to realize, hey, that's why people love this sport, because they get to debate it in a way that they don't necessarily get to debate a professional sport that has a little bit more of a rigid structure.
Yeah, it is. It truly is a great, there's a reason why Feinbaum show is so popular. It's a great debate sport, and the fans are probably among the more harder, in my opinion, harder graders when it comes to broadcasters. I certainly, Vern Lundquist, Gary Danielson, Brad Nessler, they know all about that. Last one for me is you call the women's Final Four, and that has gotten, as someone who's covered women's basketball or covered women's basketball, I haven't really done much this year, but covered it for nearly two decades for SI. Your partnership with Rebecca Lobo and Karen Lawson in the booth, rightfully so, deserved critical praise from people in the sport, people outside the sport. That's not going to happen anymore now that obviously Kara is now a coach with the Celtics. But you really, I think, immersed yourself, even for a short amount of time, in the sport. And people who cover the sport and people who care about the sport like myself really appreciate that. Why do you think that worked, Adam? Why did that fit work? Because it certainly has for the Women's Final Four.
Team, friends, teammates, I think that first and foremost, and let's not forget Holly Rowe in this mix as well. Just, I think when you have, like, I come, here's, here, let me, it's going to sound narcissistic maybe, so let me qualify it. I probably don't have to qualify it, but I want to, just so I don't sound like a complete asshole. I think I'm a good teammate. I think I'm good at this job. I do. But I think I'm, first and foremost, I think I'm a good teammate. Rebecca Lobo's really good at her job, but first and foremost, she's a really good teammate. Kara Lawson is really good. Well, I mean, again, she's coaching now for the Celtics, but when she was doing this job, she was really good at this job. But I think first and foremost, she's a good teammate, and I would say the same thing about Holly Rowe. I think when you have people that are in on an event or project together and they all want to be really good teammates, I think it comes out very, very, very clearly that everybody gets to score. I think that's the best way I can say it. We were on a team, and I do feel the same way still now when it's me, Rebecca, and Holly. And certainly I miss the hell out of Kara. She became one of my close friends, and it was great to do it. I did a couple Celtics games in December, so I got to see her a couple times and catch up with her. But I feel the same way about all three of those people. We're all in on it together. We all want each other to get swings. We all want each other to score. And then I know when it's their part, I wanted to give them as much space as possible to do the thing that they're so good at. And I think they had enough respect for me that when the biggest moments came, they wanted to make sure that I had my opportunities to score as well. And I think that showed in each of the two Final Fours that we got to do together. I think that showed off the air as well, where I think all of us just want to be good teammates to each other, and that goes for our production crew as well. I think that's what separates these. That's what I hope people realize. You know, like, what's chemistry? Chemistry is a buzzword sometimes. Like, I don't know what it necessarily means, and I don't know how to define it, quantify it, or qualify it. But I do think it just means that people want to be good teammates and they want everybody on the team to score. And when you have teams like that, Breen, Van Gundy, Jackson, Burke during the NBA Finals, when you have just groups of people, you know, whether it was the Sean McDonough, Jay Billis, Bill Raftery team that was so good on college basketball for so many years, you know, it's hard to make three-person booths work. And I think they work when everybody wants to be a good teammate. So that's what I would say about that partnership that we were lucky to have for a couple seasons.
Yeah, and listen, I you know, Holly Rowe and Rebecca Lobo both have been on this podcast. I know both of them for multiple decades. The one thing that I can say, having spent enough time around them, and certainly Kara prior to them. It really makes a difference in broadcasting, Adam, when the people you work with are like really good people. And I'm specifically saying that when it comes to those three. Like, you can, you know, you can find chemistry with someone you like a little bit, and maybe even find chemistry with someone you, you don't particularly love, but it just works on air. But when it's three people who happen to be genuinely really decent people and you get to work with them in broadcasting, that is such a pleasure. And I feel like, at least as someone who's listened to you three, and obviously Kara before, it comes through. Like, your friendship comes through. Like, it's not, it's an it feels like the broadcast is an extension of however you guys are hanging out outside of the arena.
Yeah, it's not like we're going out and partying every week or something like that. It's just, you come in with an appreciation for one another. And again, they, I guess, to try to circle it back around, just to clean, you know, put a bow on it, I guess. This is kind of what the whole positivity thing is. Like, I feel good about these people. I feel good about the people I work with. I felt that way about my college football crew this year, and I felt that way in years past about people. Maybe I'm a naive idiot, but I have a tendency to fall in love with the people I work with just because you're together for so long, and you're together on the road, and you're trying to grind through a lot of these events over the course of a long season. So I have a tendency to just fall in love with everybody I work with. And when that happens and everybody else reciprocates that, it's so easy to want them to, it's easy to want them to do great things. It's, you know, whatever that means. Again, it's a bullshit thing with, you know, this, there's a lot of subjectivity in this business. There's pretty much only subjectivity in this business at this point. So what is good is different for me, for you, for everybody else. But I think when I'm in the trenches with these people, I can feel it when it's good. And I think the common thread among feeling good with all these people is that they're good people. And I think you said it very aptly, Richard.
Last one, Adam. Be honest. How many episodes of Cinephile have you listened to in your various times listening to podcasts?
I have listened to every episode of Cinephile. And I'm not bullshitting
you. Honestly, seriously.
I was on it for the first time. Last week, talking to The Irishman, I was talking Marriage Story, but I have been a loyal listener of the fine podcast Cinephile, which is now on Cadence 13. There's your plug. I'm a loyal listener to my loyal friend Ed Edberg.
Wow, man, you talk about a love affair. That guy in Scorsese, Jesus.
He named his kids with middle names after these actors: Pacino, De Niro, and Scorsese. Good Lord.
I know. That's well, at least I hope, you know, I hope Adnan at least gets a cameo in The Irishman 2, or so, if they ever see that. All right,
That sounds like a straight to Netflix if I've ever heard.
Yeah, no kidding. All right, Adam, let me give the bio again. Adam Amin is an ESPN broadcaster who handles a variety of assignments. He just told you basically 95 assignments or something, events in 2020. Major college football. He has one of the big games on ESPN each week, or ESPN's family of networks, I should say. Does the NFL for ESPN Radio. You do men's college basketball too, right? I think I'm right about that.
Yeah, yes? Yeah, I do some men's games as well.
He's got the Women's Final Four, as you mentioned. He's done some NBA stuff, including Raptors Celtics on Christmas Day, and probably a variety of other things. And baseball as well, right? What is your MLB schedule?
You know, this past year was mostly just kind of filling in a handful of times on TV, and then a radio game every couple of weeks, and then I was part of the playoff series filling in for Berman when Berman had to go do his NFL stuff on a Sunday. I filled in on the Cardinals Braves series on radio.
Damn, just Adam Amin is always available. I don't know. Pitaro's not going to be listening, but you know the Lee Fittings of the world might be. The Connor Shells of the world. This guy, talk about a loyalist here. Let's give this guy a raise. All right, Adam, is there anything else that you need to say on this lower rated podcast than the one that Adnan and Mike Lombardi do? It'll be going to less listeners. So make it count.
Oh, so this is just an excuse for it to throw a nice little body shot at the end of it. That's all good. Yeah. What are you most excited about? I ask you this as a person who covers the media, what are you most excited about story-wise in 2020?
I'm just me sleeping more, basically, because I have the young kids.
I don't think that's going to work with the kids.
I'm not excited about anything. Let me think about this. You're putting me on the spot. No, I'm a sports media nerd, so I get interested and excited about a lot of things. But I think 2020, two things. No one wants to hear my opinion. This is a guest-driven podcast this week. But one, obviously, what happens with the NFL media rights, whenever that starts cooking, and I think we'll obviously see some movement in that in the calendar year 2020. But because I'm certainly very interested in politics and read a ton of stuff on politics and social issues, I think how sports outlets navigate the 2020 presidential election is particularly fascinating to me, including and maybe specifically your place, given many different reasons. I don't want you to go down that pike. But those, I think, honestly, are the two that really interest me, because I think they're two very different topics, but they're two equally fascinating topics. So, and I'm psyched for the women's Final Four, because UConn is I think better than people thought, and Oregon State is awesome, and Oregon obviously is going to be a top team, and you have Baylor. I love when there's no definitive favorite for a title, and that's why I think it's a great year this year in women's college basketball.
Yeah, I think we all had a sense of Oregon being this powerhouse that, you know, who might stop them. And then eight games in, here's Louisville without Asia Durr stepping up and knocking them off down in the Virgin Islands or St. Thomas, whatever it was. So I'm pumped for it, man. I think this is going to be – we've been very lucky. I've done six women's Final Four games, and all of them have been, like, amazing games. I can only hope that it's going to be the same thing in 2020.
Yeah, listen, you don't root, and I don't root, but I love the fact that Sabrina Ionescu came back to win a title.
Yeah.
So if nothing else, I'd like to see her get that shot. I'd like to see them in the title game, and then obviously whoever they face. But there's a lot of good teams. And like you said, man, I did not see that Louisville upset coming, but Jeff Waltz is always a good coach. So if you're a women's college basketball fan, it's going
to
be a fun year. All right, listen, Adam, you gave me more time than I expected, and I appreciate that. And when Adnan does the post edits for this podcast, I will say hi for sure.
Yeah, thanks, man. I appreciate it.
All right, everybody. Adam Amin. All right, my thanks to Adam Amin for an excellent conversation, and certainly check out his work across the ESPN platforms. If you enjoy this kind of content, head to the Sports Media with Richard Deitch page on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher. Give us a 5-star review. Leave us a rating. That's how this podcast continues. The guest before Adam Amin was Jim Ross, the iconic wrestling broadcaster. Now you can hear his work at AEW. And Joe Neeson, a longtime Sports Illustrated writer who has been on with us a couple times to talk about what life is like after a company foolishly lets you go. Prior to that, Joe Buck of Fox Sports for what I thought was a really honest and in-depth conversation about Joe Buck's career. Just go through all the archives and you'll find something I think you like. Did want to mention a couple things I did for The Athletic that I think you guys may find really interesting. Our Sports Broadcaster of the Year, I should say my Sports Broadcaster of the Year, sort of a made-up thing anyway, was Kevin Harlan. And I did a long Q&A with him where we talked a lot about his preparation and his schedule. He's just got a basically crazy schedule from given he does the NBA for TNT a lot of times on Thursdays, and then we'll do a Sunday game for CBS and then a Monday Night Football game for Westwood One. So I've been really in depth on just how he preps for that, how he is able to be, at least in my judgment, such a high quality broadcaster given multiple assignments in a week. So I think you'll find that long conversation interesting. Also on The Athletic right now for me, the 160 best things I read this year, or at least the things that were very impactful to me. I think people who listen to this podcast know how much I love to read. And so I'm hoping you can find something there that impacts you, some incredible journalism this year. And then there's two other things that you may be interested in. I spent the Chiefs-Patriots game embedding with the Tony Romo, Tracy Wolfson, Jim Nantz, Jim Rickoff, Mike Arnold crew. And first time they let a reporter in there. And that's up on The Athletic for a 4,000-word-plus story where I try to take you inside how that production group works and why they put on such a good broadcast. And then as we head out of 2019 into 2020, I asked 40 people, including Adam Amin, who are well-known in the sports media world. What advice would you give yourself at the end of 2009, if you could basically go back 10 years from now and give yourself some professional or personal advice? So a lot of December content for me on The Athletic right now. Check that out. Want to thank Patrick Antonetti, as always, for producing this podcast. I guess not as always, but generally speaking, he is the main producer of this podcast. Thank you to Chris Corcoran and John McDermott, Spencer Brown, Sean Cherry at Cadence 13. Appreciate those guys' support. Wish them a great 2020 heading forward. Cadence 13 obviously doing some great things in the podcast space. And thanks to everybody for listening. At the end of the day, this is a niche podcast, but it's a niche podcast that has been really supported incredibly well by viewers, or listeners, I should say. So I appreciate that very much. All right, this is Richard Deitch. We will see you in 2020. Thanks so much for listening to the Sports Media Podcast.